listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the 31st annual Hollywood issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is a double issue and covers December of 2024 and January of 2025, and this is Vanity Fair Part A. Here's the continuation of Murder at Hammersmith Farm by James Robinault. By July 4th, JFK was ensconced in Hyannisport, basking in the accomplishments of a marathon month. But then, quite dramatically, the energy began to shift. On August 7th, the First Lady decided to accompany her 5-year-old daughter, Caroline, to horseback riding lessons at Allen Farm in Osterville, 6 miles west of Hyannisport. Jackie was 8 months pregnant and had limited her activities. She had a history of difficult pregnancies, including a miscarriage, a stillbirth, and her son John F. Kennedy Jr.'s premature birth. Landis noticed Jackie walking toward him with deliberation shortly after their arrival. She said they had to leave immediately, but asked him not to interrupt Caroline's lesson. Landis drove her back to Hyannis, a bumpy ride. Then a helicopter transported both of them to the military hospital at Otis Air Force Base, where doctors performed a cesarean birth. The baby boy, Patrick, was 5.5 weeks premature, his lungs not fully developed. After being taken to a Boston hospital, Patrick died on August 9th in a high-pressure hyperbaric chamber as the president held his tiny hand. JFK's desperate prayers for the life of his second son echoed his own father's prayers for him when he was just 2 and hospitalized in Boston with scarlet fever, his temperature spiking to 105. Through his grief, might Kennedy have wondered if Patrick's death presaged his own? At the very least, the president was forced to intensify his focus on his life's priorities. What is certain is that his behavior changed. He renewed his close relationship with Jackie, and according to biographer Clark, ceased his rampant womanizing. Knowing that Jackie had suffered from severe postpartum depression in the past, Kennedy was determined to keep her spirits up. "You know, Jackie," he said, "we must not create an atmosphere of sadness in the White House, because this would not be good for anyone, not for the country, and not for the work we have to do." Clark observed, his reference to the work we have to do stressed their partnership in a way that Jackie had to find gratifying and promising. According to her mother, it made a profound impression on her. Realizing that Jackie needed some time to get away and process her grief, her sister, Lee Radziwill, asked her to come along on a trip to Greece a few weeks later. Though JFK at first had been concerned about the optics of such a trip, especially since Radziwill reputedly was having an affair with Greek shipping magnate Aristotle Onassis, Jackie would marry Onassis in 1968. Kennedy, at his wife's insistence, eventually relented. In October, the sisters departed, accompanied by agents Landis and Clint Hill. While in Greece, says Landis, Jackie confided that she would soon join her husband on a domestic political trip, something she had mostly avoided. Landis understood the First Lady's decision. He, too, recognized a reinvigorated bond between the two, sensing that they were determined to spend more time together. It was during this period of trying to lighten the mood that the President and First Lady came up with the idea of a home movie. JFK was clowning with Faye. Jackie had her interest in photography and directing, and JFK loved the James Bond books as well as movies in general. He had spent time in Hollywood, where his father had run 3 film studios. Kennedy even thought of writing his own spy novels. JFK's interest in 007 author Ian Fleming had begun in 1954 when he read Casino Royale while recovering from back surgery. He met privately with Fleming during the 1960 campaign. A year later, when Time Life correspondent Hugh Seide wrote about the new president's reading habits, Kennedy praised Fleming's work. Like many of the world's leaders, Seide noted, he has a weakness for detective stories, especially those of British author Ian Fleming and his fictitious undercover man, James Bond. At the time, Bond thrillers were only beginning to catch on in America, but with Kennedy's endorsement, sales soared. The first 007 movie, Dr. No, hit U.S. theaters in May 1963. At some point that summer, the president, on a lark, sketched out a script for his own short humorous film. Navy Chief Robert L. Knutson was JFK and Jackie's go-to person for home movies in Newport. Records from the projectionist at the White House screening room show that Jackie, while enjoying a variety of films there, took immense pleasure in watching family footage. Tech reporter Matt Novak of Gizmodo wrote in 2016, "The films that Jackie Kennedy watched in the White House are a mixture of diplomatic necessity, USIA propaganda movies, familial bonding, cartoons and home movies, and high-class foreign films. Of course, some of the films are perhaps better described as middlebrow and included at least two James Bond movies." Knutson's story is not well known. An Iowa native, he was nearly the same age as Jackie. While she was in Paris in college, Knutson, having graduated first in his class at the Naval Photographic School, was just starting as a personal photographer for President Harry Truman. When Dwight Eisenhower became president, Knutson thought his career in the White House was over. Knutson was Navy. Eisenhower and his top staff were Army. In fact, Cecil Staunton, an Army Signal Corps sergeant, later promoted to captain, was brought on board to take up photographic chores. Even so, Eisenhower kept Knutson on the dole. Rather savvy about PR, the new president, who would hire actor Robert Montgomery as the first full-time White House consultant to engage with industry leaders in Hollywood, understood the importance of disseminating pictures to the public and the press. At Ike's suggestion, Knutson located a storage space on the ground floor of the West Wing to establish quarters for the White House photo staff in order to be closer to the action in the Oval Office. When JFK won the presidency in 1960, Knutson knew he would have an in with a former naval officer. To his good fortune, he ended up serving six presidents, from Truman to Ford. But he was especially close to Kennedy, capturing some of the most iconic photos of JFK in Berlin and Ireland. For this article, Landis and I interviewed Knutson's son, also a photographer and also named Robert Knutson. His father died in 1989. The younger Knutson, who lives outside Washington, D.C., told us that the film of the staged murder had been shot and edited by his father. He recounted how the amateur movie was meant to loosely parody a Bond caper and that the First Lady, a film buff, had directed each scene. Once completed, a duplicate of the edited movie, he said, had been sent to Red Fay. Another went to Jackie. No other copies are thought to exist. Knutson believes that Fay, perhaps distraught after the assassination, destroyed his copy. Knutson has no idea what became of Jackie's. But fortunately for history, Knutson's father kept some of the footage used to make the film, snippets of which are still in the son's possession. In all, Knutson has approximately 7 minutes from the original shoots, which he screened for me at his home in Virginia. For security reasons, all of his father's materials are maintained off-site. Knutson is cooperating with the production company Moxie Pictures on a documentary based on Landis's book, The Final Witness. As it turns out, There were multiple parts to the staged movie. The only time the elder Knutson spoke about the filming with the press was right after Ralph Martin's book was released, 20 years after the assassination. He told the Associated Press that Kennedy wrote the script and that for each scene there had been several different takes. In some, JFK is the person shot. In others, Faye is the person who falls. In amateur fashion, they had used Heinz ketchup to make it appear as though they were bleeding. The first scene was enacted on the Newport Pier that led to Hammersmith Farm. In this clip, the presidential party exits the honey fits. Then, JFK suddenly clutches his chest and falls, as if hit by bullets. And in an absurd touch, those behind him nonchalantly step over him. Faye then trips and falls on top of the president, and a gush of red surged from the president's mouth, soiling the front of his shirt. The whole vibe of the film was less Bond than the detective spoof The Pink Panther, which would premiere in theaters the following March. Unbeknownst to the Kennedys or the actors, two reporters in a nearby chase boat, Frank Cormier of AP and Merriman Smith of UPI, were watching the group through binoculars. A photographer with them, likely a Newport freelancer or an AP staffer or stringer, had a camera with a zoom lens. Knudsen's son has two prints from that long-ago shoot, which, as far as he knows, have never surfaced. At the time, the reporters only wrote about the version of the home movie in which Faye is the victim. One of the photos shows Knudsen in a business suit, perched atop a pier post with his movie camera, eerily foreshadowing amateur photographer Abraham Zapruder standing on a concrete abutment in Dealey Plaza in Dallas 2 months later. Off to the side, JFK holds a towel, presumably using it to clean off the ketchup that had spurted from his mouth. Jackie stands next to Knudsen, looking like she is directing the scene. Two children are also visible, Caroline and Marc Antonio Crespi, the son of Countess Vivian Stokes Crespi. The Countess was also a guest that weekend. She and Jackie had met in Newport, where their mothers were friends. A statuesque blonde, Vivi had married an Italian-Brazilian count, Marco Fabio Crespi, but the two were in divorce proceedings by then. Their only child, Marco Antonio, became a childhood companion of Caroline's. A small article, sans photo, ran on the AP wire that night and was picked up in newspapers, describing the scene at the pier, along with headlines such as Kennedy's cut up for camera at weekend retreat, and Kennedy's Faye get big scene down on film. But the reporters were not privy to the action filmed at the Hammersmith Mansion. A sequence shot by Knudsen in front of the house was taken from a third-floor balcony. It shows a station wagon full of Secret Service agents racing from their command post and screeching to a halt before eight of them jump out. The actors, at Jackie's urging, were actual agents, including Roy Kellerman, Jerry Blaine, Art Godfrey, and Landis. "We're making a movie about the president's murder," she told them, "and we'd like you and the other agents to drive up to the front of the house, then jump out and run toward the door." So they did, and when they entered, according to Landis, they found the president lying in the foyer. Jackie, sitting on the stairs leading to the second floor, nodded as they ran in, while Knudsen kept filming. Everyone applauded when she said cut. I asked Landis to authenticate what remains of Knudsen's footage. Sure enough, the film shows the agents, including Landis, scrambling out of a station wagon in front of Hammersmith Farm, looking startled and then laughing. A third series of scenes was taken behind the house. In these vignettes, a love triangle is played out between Crespi, Faye, and Jackie's stepbrother, Hugh D. Yusha Auchincloss, who lived in a separate home on Hammersmith Farm. Both men practice cuddling with the Countess, while the other happens upon them and, startled by what he sees, retreats from the room. Jealousy appears to end in the murder of one of the secret lovers. There are other miscellaneous takes filmed on the Honey Fits that variously show Jackie directing and JFK sitting next to Faye, who has a rope around his neck and ketchup on his mouth and shoulder, as well as scenes in which the Countess and Faye drop a pistol into a bag that is then surreptitiously spirited away. In related footage, Jackie carries the bag with the pistol, either directing or acting in the movie. On Sunday, the day after the reporters witnessed the action on the pier, Knudsen reported for work at Hammersmith Farm before the Kennedys were about to go to church, and was told that the president was furious with him. He was flummoxed. What had he done? Apparently, JFK thought that Knudsen, who hadn't even read the AP item, had leaked the information that appeared in the story. He was summarily dismissed and told to head to the airport to return to Washington. But at the airport, he encountered either the reporters or the photographer, who shared both the article and two photographic prints, including one showing Knudsen standing on the pier with JFK. Knudsen immediately took the photos back to the president, who was relieved to see that the news story had not been the result of a leak by Knudsen. He had not wanted to fire the man he affectionately called Chief, who then dutifully went with the family to church. Knudsen quickly returned his attention to the movie, editing the scenes into a short film. Records from the White House Theater reveal that JFK and Jackie, accompanied by Faye and close family friend Bill Walton, screened home movies the next day, September 23rd. A week later, before Jackie left for Greece, she and JFK viewed the spy movie a second time with the Washington Post Ben Bradley, a confidant of the president's and Bradley's then-wife, socialite Toni Pinchot, an artist-designer who had been on the staff at Vogue and was a close friend of the First Lady's. Evidently, the Kennedys were keen to share their joint creation with the arts-oriented pair. The content of the film, no matter how lighthearted at the time, would prove ominous. Looking back, the elder Knudsen saw a prophecy. I wondered if it was a premonition he had, he told the AP in 1983, or a quirk of fate. Around this time, a psychiatrist in Palm Beach, where the Kennedys had a winter compound, spoke with the press about his own personal knowledge of JFK's premonitions. McKinley Cheshire said of the home movie, "It could easily have been just a fantasy to release a lot of his own internal fears and counter his own phobic behavior, an effort to face the reality that his life was indeed in great danger." He also sensed that the president allowing others to step over his fallen body was his way of saying they must carry on without him. If JFK had harbored any premonitions about his death at that point, they were clearly not specific enough to persuade him to change his plans to go to Dallas. There is another oddity in the narrative that would hint at the misfortune to follow. The Kennedys watched dozens and dozens of films in the White House Theater during JFK's time in office, and the official logs of their screenings contain an intriguing entry on August 29, 1962. That day, Kennedy, along with his brother Robert, viewed the soon-to-be-released movie The Manchurian Candidate, the neo-noir thriller starring Frank Sinatra about a U.S. serviceman who was captured by Soviet and Chinese agents in Korea and brainwashed to kill a presidential candidate. The penultimate scene shows the murderer loading a gun that resembles the bolt-action rifle used by Lee Harvey Oswald in JFK's assassination. Oswald, as it turns out, was a Marine who had spent time in the Soviet Union. Reportedly, Sinatra had approached JFK to ask for his sign-off before appearing in the picture, portraying the character who attempts to foil the assassin's plot. In hindsight, the coincidences between these filmed fictions and cold reality are chilling. Knudsen was not in Dallas on November 22nd. Why? His son says that it was, in his words, another quirk of fate. His father had suffered an injury while working on antique furniture when a splinter flew into his eye, resulting in a brief trip to the hospital. He was recovering when JFK called to tell him of an upcoming trip to Miami, Tampa, and Dallas. Learning of Knudsen's condition, he told Chief to take the week off. "I'm going down to Florida and then over to Dallas with Lyndon to get some more votes, and nothing's going to happen," the president said. "Be with your family. Enjoy them. We need to spend more time with our families." The next time Knudsen would see the president would be in the morgue at Bethesda Naval Hospital, where he was tasked with taking autopsy photos. Those lost photos comprise a different tale about lost film footage. But that's another story. Citizen Chambers. Until very recently, Jim Fergie Chambers was an heir to Cox Enterprises and one of the largest family fortunes in America. With hundreds of millions of dollars on hand, a zeal for revolution, and an innate sense for confrontation, he's becoming America's go-to radical communist, by Dan Adler. Opening illustration by Dominic Bodden, which shows Jim Fergie Chambers in scenes from his life that are depicted like an old WPA mural. There's a story among the St. Anne's school class of 2002, so neat as to seem apocryphal, that Jim Fergie Chambers first learned the extent of his family's fortune from a magazine. In his own telling, when he was around 11 or 12, a classmate showed him a copy of a Forbes 400 list. While Chambers had previously marveled at his grandmother's estate in the south of France with its 75-acre vineyard, only now did he realize that Anne Cox Chambers was something like the 10th richest person in America and among the 10 wealthiest women on earth. His Brooklyn private school possessed an air of bohemianism. The parents were successful artists, not bankers or lawyers like the ones at Manhattan schools with similar tuitions. Chambers's classmates, whom he'd largely known since kindergarten and who have known him almost exclusively as Fergie, were rich too, and they went off to elite colleges. But as they understood it, they were not that kind of rich. It wasn't talked about at all until maybe that Forbes thing one of them recently recalled, and even that memory is kind of replaced by the tale. I'm not sure if I remember it, or if I just know because it's come up in the last 10, 15 years. Like many St. Anne's alumni, this classmate has been trying to piece together the arc Chambers has undertaken in the period since their graduation. It is not a straightforward task, given his facility for shaping the dramatic contours of his autobiography, especially lately as the cartoonish contrast of his life have become a minor fixation in political media. His grandmother, it turned out, was the daughter of James M. Cox, the two-time governor of Ohio and 1920 Democratic presidential nominee, who founded what would become Cox Enterprises, a global communications, media, and automotive conglomerate based in Atlanta that is estimated to generate $22 billion in annual revenue. Chambers was endowed from birth with a slice of the family-owned business and briefly worked for it, but he has more recently referred to his relatives as the Cox Klux Klan. The Coxes are worth a reported $26.8 billion, putting them a bit below the Waltons and Kochs and just above the Lauders and Hearst in the rankings of American wealth. Chambers' cousin Alex Taylor is the fourth family member to serve as Cox Enterprises' CEO. His father, Jim Cox Chambers, is part owner of the Atlanta Hawks and chairs the Bard College Board of Trustees. He and Chambers' mother, Lauren Hamilton, the daughter of pioneering computer scientist Margaret Hamilton, divorced when their son was two. Jim Cox Chambers later married the daughter of billionaire Saudi arms dealer Adnan Khashoggi. Fergie Chambers, 39, was in and out of rehab and mental institutions, starting at 11. After St. Anne's, he drifted among marriages, businesses, and callings. Money was a through line, though, and so was communism. In middle school, a history teacher gave him Lenin to read, and he was hooked. He eventually decorated his body in Soviet-inspired tattoos, including one on his neck that read ACAB, until he modified it to create a Russian word amounting to attaboy. In the spring of 2022, shortly after the war in Ukraine broke out, Chambers was in Sicily with Stella Schnabel, then his sometime girlfriend and the mother of his fourth child. Schnabel, the daughter of painter and director Julian, went to school with Chambers growing up, and they reunited a few years ago. Already in Europe and sensing an opportunity, Chambers headed to the Donbas region and to Russia, where he wrote dispatches touting the righteousness of Vladimir Putin's invasion. When Chambers returned to the U.S., members of the Cox family and their lawyers asked him, he said, to sign paperwork promising that if he went to Russia again, he would dissociate his holdings as an heir. He could be seen as an unregistered foreign agent, they said, which he understood to be a threat. A spokesperson for Cox Enterprises said the company doesn't comment on family matters. The following year, Chambers learned Cox Enterprises had invested $10 million to fund the Atlanta Public Safety Training Center, a planned law enforcement facility known colloquially as Cop City. The new construction has drawn intense protest, in which Chambers participated and which he financially supported when he lived there, and a resulting legal crackdown that has included domestic terrorism and racketeering charges. Taylor, his CEO cousin, led the project's fundraising as the honorary chair of Atlanta's Police Fund, and the editorial board of the Cox-owned Atlanta Journal-Constitution wrote in support of the planned facility. ATL is corrupt as hell, Chambers wrote on X, and the Cox family are enemies of the people. Then, this past July, Chambers made an announcement. I've become the first Cox to fully detach from the company, he wrote in an expansive statement. In the past, I withheld from aggressively pursuing such a move because I maintained some family bonds and because I was no more at odds with Cox than with any other tentacle of the American bourgeoisie. Cop City, he said, changed his thinking. He agreed to trade his shares for lump sums, including a $250 million initial payout. I got A-Rod's Texas Rangers deal in one day, he told me this fall, with a mix of astonishment and pride. Unshackled and flush, Chambers set out to fund his causes and make what he acknowledges is a spectacle of himself. Amid his jittery streams of social media posts, he homed in on his family and background. As the Israel-Hamas war began last fall, he made a list of relatives, or relatives by proxy, his father, his stepmother, his cousin, his stepbrother, Schnabel's father and brother, and the ways each aided Israel or fell short of supporting Palestine. With his appetite for recognition and mostly unerring projection of certainty, Chambers was a quick stand-in for the larger cultural convulsion unfolding at so many American institutions, such as Ivy League schools and art and literary magazines. Egged on, he engaged with many of the tabloid and right-wing media outlets that were more frequently seeking him out. He had moved to New Hampshire for tax advantages, but continued to operate a gym and farm on the land he owns in Alford, Massachusetts, where his ostensible affinity for guns prompted concerned local news coverage. Chambers has not become an influential political figure, but he has a tendency to conduct himself as if he has, making for a disorienting micro-celebrity infamy. He had long been a wayward scion, but he was now an emblem of some larger dynastic corrosion. His relationships with his parents had deteriorated beyond repair. Mother Jones and Air Mail interviewed him. A Rolling Stone reporter followed him to a protest at Cop City. In December, a year ago, a producer for Dr. Phil reached out. Chambers grew up in his mother's brownstone in Brooklyn. During one of our first conversations, he described the environment at school as the fallout of the sort of 80s bohemian bourgeoisie. His father was in Los Angeles for a large chunk of his childhood, but had an apartment on the floor above Yoko Ono at the Dakota. At six, Chambers began seeing a psychiatrist because he was still wetting his bed, and he said that he was medicated before age 10. The amount of focus and attention and pathologization from an early age was pretty intense, he said. He was having tantrums and went to a psych ward in the eighth grade, where he said he was put in a straitjacket and injected with Thorazine. Chambers said a 16-year-old patient there raped him. Chambers started smoking cigarettes and weed. He switched to LSD when he left the ward, and his parents began having him tested for drugs. In high school, he struggled with heroin and crack and was institutionalized more regularly. A friend saw him shoot up at CBGB and called his parents. They staged an intervention. When he and his father took a charter jet to Utah for him to attend a wilderness rehab program, he said a doorman from the Dakota came with them as security. He snuck heroin on board and took it into the bathroom. The elder Chambers broke down the door, His son punched him in the face. His father didn't return request for comment. In the view of some classmates, Chambers was reasonably well-liked and socially integrated at St. Anne's, though not entirely esteemed. They recalled him shifting identities in a manner that went beyond workaday teenage phases. He said he was gay at one time and claimed membership in the Bloods at another. As one peer put it, he was all these other things before Rich Kid. No one thought that he was going anywhere, another said, and neither did he. Chambers remembered himself as more of an outsider. I mostly hung out with the kids who came around St. Anne's to sell drugs and smoke cigarettes outside, he said. Chambers has claimed that his classmate Lena Dunham got him kicked out of school by informing the administration that he was selling drugs. He had been dating her friend, who attended another private school in the neighborhood. Some classmates remembered the sequence of events differently and attributed his dismissal to a wider range of misbehavior. Dunham didn't respond to her request for comment. She didn't effing like me, he recalled, and I didn't effing like Lena Dunham either. Other classmates, he said, were better known than him but not as wealthy, and he rattled off some names, Jemima Kirk, Ava Amuri, Francesco Clementi's daughter. In his default free associative manner before letting out a snicker, Chambers can speak more or less interrupted for hours with a sense of awe at his own intrepidness. He's fond of Huey Newton's notion that anything can be revolutionary at a particular point in time, often locating world historical valences in his personal trajectory. His nearly 3 years in psych wards, rehabs, and a little bit of jail, but not a ton of jail, were, he said, a big part of how I ended up where I ended up, coming up against the state in that way, or coming up against the discipline of the ruling class in that way. When we talked on this occasion, Chambers was dealing with a blood clot from a jiu-jitsu tournament. He has also boxed and practiced Muay Thai. He had recently returned from Atlanta, where three of his children live with his first wife, and where he attended a conference organized by the International People's Assembly, a network of anti-imperialist and anti-capitalist groups. Chambers returned to St. Anne's in time to graduate. He figured somebody's donation helped his cause. He attended noon AA meetings at a church next to the school throughout his senior year. He was upset after breaking up with his high school girlfriend and took his first of several gap years. He worked on his father's organic vegetable farm in Columbia County for cash and, obsessed with Henry Miller, drove his dog to California in his mother's old Volvo. I'm sleeping with women, he remembered, and writing about it like some total effing dilettante little piece of shit. He protested the Iraq War, got swept up in a few catch-and-release arrests, and canvassed for Ralph Nader in Washington, D.C. His interest in linen had by then extended to a broader Russophilia. While visiting a friend at Bard, he saw a blonde Russian girl named Anya Vostrova and declared his intent to marry her. He began attending the college the next year. He'd been staying sober, but after seeing the liberal arts students excited about their first experiments with weed, he felt a competitive streak kick in. He cooked crack in the dorms and nodded out in someone's room, and Bard asked him to leave. Around this time, Chambers temporarily dropped Fergie, a nickname his parents had decided on while he was in the womb. He worked for his godfather, Chris Good, an occasional film producer who opened the 80s nightclub area, studied acting, and played baseball. After Aaron Boone knocked his beloved Red Sox out of the 2003 American League Championship Series, he blacked out in Brooklyn and started a few fights. He woke up yelling at his mother and Vostrova, now his girlfriend. He headed back upstate to AA meetings near Bard, where he fell in with a group of older Christian men. Chambers declared himself Catholic, preferring his pathway for pretension to his new friend's Protestantism, and railed against contraception. He disavowed punk rock and all the rest of his old identity, and said he was just a conservative American guy named Jim. Chambers proposed to Vostrova, a child of middle-class immigrants who grew up on Long Island when he was 21 years old. She was pregnant 2 weeks later. When they married at La Petite Fontanelle, his grandmother's estate in Provence, the ceremony stretched over several days. Humbled and newly moored to tradition, Chambers decided to go to work for the family business. "We've made something of ourselves in this country," he thought, or something. Chambers went to the Mannheim auto auction on the west side of Atlanta. He was in a management training program, but emphasized to me that he related better to both the redneck white people and the cats from the hood who dealt with the actual cars and the layoffs that arrived with the Great Recession. Vostrova became pregnant again, and Chambers showed up to events with his family in the Tony Buckhead area. But he was miserable, chain-smoking parliaments and watching his weight balloon from a diet of Chick-fil-A and sweet tea. His grandmother was on Bard's board at this point, before his father eventually took her seat, and the Ann Cox Chambers Alumni Center is one of the first buildings you see driving onto campus. Chambers got a call from Leon Botstein, the college's president of nearly 50 years, who has received some scrutiny recently for the donations Bard received from Jeffrey Epstein. "We're a family to you," Chambers remembered him saying. "You should come back here." The idea was that he could study economics, but in about a month he was in Russian and writing classes and starting a baseball team. Chambers had by now gotten his first trust fund payout of around $1 million and a bit of income through an investment. As he saw it, though, he was still in the dark. "I don't know if I have to work for money. No one's told me anything." James M. Cox was born in a log cabin on an Ohio farm in 1870. While working as a young reporter at the Cincinnati Enquirer, he found a mentor in a local businessman who had won a seat in Congress. At 28, with the help of the congressman and money borrowed from friends and family, Cox acquired the Dayton Daily News. He bought the Springfield Daily News several years later. Both papers are still owned by Cox Enterprises. Over the next decade, Cox won his own seat in Congress, was elected governor of Ohio, and built a 5-bedroom French Renaissance home in a Dayton suburb. In 1920, he ran for president with Franklin D. Roosevelt as his running mate, but the ticket lost in a rout to Warren G. Harding. Cox returned to the media business. He bought the Miami Metropolis newspaper and aired the first television broadcast in Atlanta, where he owned the paper that would become the Journal Constitution, as well as its affiliated AM station. WSB Radio operated for a period out of a colonial revival-style mansion known as White Columns, and WSB-TV adopted the tagline, "Eyes of the South." When Cox died in 1957, his son Jim Jr. took over the company as CEO and nearly one-third owner. He expanded into cable and automotive and had a late-in-life conservative turn, ordering his newspaper editors in 1972 to get behind Richard Nixon. Today, the family is for all intents exclusively aligned with Democrats, and the business revolves primarily around cable, internet, and the automotive sector, though its media holdings have the more visible profile. The company acquired the news site Axios in 2022 after selling a majority stake in its broadcast stations a few years prior. When Jim Jr. died, his two half-sisters came into 95% ownership of Cox Enterprises. Barbara chaired the newspapers in Dayton and Ann, Fergie's grandmother, in Atlanta. They expanded the family's social and philanthropic stature. Ann had been an early supporter of Jimmy Carter. The Georgia governor's mansion had no pool, so he swam across the road at hers and became ambassador to Belgium once he was elected president. As with so many American dynasties, the Cox heirs eventually strayed further afield. The third generation includes Fergie's father, Jim, the most devoutly eccentric of his siblings and cousins, an alternative medicine enthusiast who amassed stacks of aging newspapers in his Manhattan apartment. According to his son, he was Anne's favorite child. Some of that had to do with him kind of being a real person who loved punk rock, Chambers said. Jim met Chambers' mother, Lauren Hamilton, at Bard. Hamilton grew up in Cambridge, Massachusetts, where her mother, Margaret, worked on NASA projects at MIT and coined the term software engineering as she programmed the flight operating systems for the Apollo 11 mission. Chambers has had strong relationships with both of his grandmothers. After Anne's death in 2020, Margaret is the only blood relative with whom he remains close. Jim and Lauren married shortly after graduation, and both soon had small parts in Amos Poe's 1984 mafia noir, Alphabet City. Fergie was born in 1985. Lauren left acting behind, and after their divorce, Jim moved to Los Angeles, where he made documentaries, pursued dancing, and wore his hair in dreadlocks. He saw Fergie every other Christmas in Provence, and when he took his son to the Super Bowl in Atlanta in 1994. Jim moved back to New York when Fergie began to struggle more severely as a teenager. During the 2000 World Series between the Mets and Yankees, he called Fergie and told him he was thinking of going to a game. He picked his son and a friend up in a limo, and they sat next to Rudy Giuliani. At Yankee Stadium, Fergie said he saw more clearly that something is really going on, something a little bit more than Grandma has a nice car. Later, reading the German sociologist Max Weber's The Protestant Ethic and the Spirit of Capitalism, he had a theoretical basis for his family's relationship to its wealth. Put your head down. You're one of God's chosen, he said. My family's particularly hush-hush. I think WASPs tend to be that way. Maybe a family of Italian shipping billionaires are a little more open about it. That's one of the really easy ways for me to counter their agenda, he supposed, remembering a lesson he learned at a young age. Just to take my pants off. Here we are. This is what's going on. Hey. After Bard, Chambers, still Catholic and sober, spent a few years living part-time in Russia with Vostrova. The couple planned to unite under the same church with their two children. Chambers thought he would convert his wife, but after taking in the guys with deep operatic voices and beards and cathedrals built by Catherine the Great, I'm like, okay, I was wrong, you're right, and I think I'm Russian Orthodox. He and Vostrova had their third child and decided to move. With his trust fund maturing, Chambers had a couple million more dollars, and when he went to Atlanta for his grandmother's 90th birthday party, he heard about a few gyms for sale. So that's how I met this totally apolitical lady who was unhappy with her marriage, Chambers said. One of Chambers' more notable registers on the national radar came in 2020 during Marjorie Taylor Greene's conspiracy-fueled campaign for Congress. Chambers, it emerged, had employed the future U.S. representative at his Alpharetta gym in 2012. As Greene sought her district's Republican nomination, she often invoked her Christian faith, and Chambers aired some of the gym's gossip on X. The extramarital affairs you had with Justin and Craig, he wrote, those were Jesus-approved, right? The allegation didn't get any press until after Greene won her primary a few months later. The Daily Mail ultimately enshrined it under the headline, Embattled QAnon Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene openly cheated on her husband of 25 years with a polyamorous tantric sex guru and then moved on to another affair with a manager at her gym. Greene called the story ridiculous tabloid garbage spread by an avowed communist and another attempt to smear my name because I'm the biggest threat to the Democrats' socialist agenda. Neither man denied an affair to the Mail. Chambers found himself once again restless. I'm starting to have this feeling, he said, of just like, where have I been for these last years? He took a painting class and went to the Prado in Madrid, revisiting the prospect of an artistic future. He went with friends to Amsterdam. He had recently begun smoking weed again, and was drinking with no real trouble. They headed to his grandmother's in France, where Vostrova had gone with the kids, and saw them for a few days before flying to Morocco and Iceland. "I don't know what I'm doing," he recalled. "I'm being super manic." A woman at a bar in Reykjavik asked him for a cigarette, and he spent 5 days with her. When he came back, Vostrova read his Facebook messages. "I don't want to be married anymore," he told his wife. "I don't know who the F I am." He couch-surfed in Atlanta and read political theory. One of his father's ex-girlfriends came to town. Chambers met her for drinks and said they spent the night together. When he woke up hungover, he went to a cafe and saw Andre 3000 sitting at the counter, as well as an incredibly beautiful girl. He declared his intent to marry Cameron Park. On some occasions, when he provokes backlash online, Chambers' detractors resurface his mugshot. His relationship with Park spanned one of the most volatile periods of his adult life thus far, starting from its earliest days. He was arrested in 2013 on battery and false imprisonment charges, and amid his retelling of his life story, he brought the episode up before I could ask about it. He claimed, though, that because he had been on a week-long bender, "I don't even know the details, man. We go effing apeshit," he said. "I'm trying to throw myself out the window. I definitely hit her. She definitely hit me." Park declined to comment. The admission seemed to function as a gesture of self-awareness, a kind of inoculation. "I understand people who don't want to F with me," Chambers added. An incident report from the arrest said that, according to Park, Chambers broke her laptop and phone, and that when she tried to leave the apartment, he slammed the door closed on her leg and forced her back in. When she tried to leave again, she stated, he pulled her by her hair down a concrete hall and banged her head on the floor. There was no mention of Park hitting him, but she stated that she pushed him to get him off of her before going to a nearby friend's house and waiting for the police. The report said that Chambers initially told an officer that the argument did not turn physical before acknowledging that he shut Park's leg in the door and asked her not to leave. According to Chambers, while he was in jail, the Coxes sent the Atlanta criminal defense attorney Ed Garland, a sixth-generation lawyer who had previously represented T.I. Ben Roethlisberger and Ray Lewis. Chambers claimed that Park told authorities that they were both strung out and didn't know what happened. According to a person familiar with the night's circumstances, Park didn't know at the time that Chambers was wealthy. She ultimately did not pursue charges. Chambers was expanding his activist ambitions. He wanted to become a political person in a meaningful way. He met Housing and Occupy Wall Street organizers and donated some money. He protested when Michael Brown was killed in Ferguson. He went back to rehab, but it didn't stick. Personal inventories and making amends didn't improve his outlook. "I feel so guilty about what I've done to this woman," he said. "What I did to Anya, what I've done with my whole life as a rich kid who's a waste." He and Park left AA and opened a cafe boutique that stocked Rachel Comey and Enric Vibskov. They married in 2014. In a Facebook post in 2016, he wrote about what a recent night in jail said about his whiteness and wealth. He had been sleepwalking nude and high when a neighbor called the cops. When Barbara Cox died in 2007, most of the rest of the company was wrapped up in Anne's estate. As Anne entered her 90s, Chambers said, his family started to get freaked out about estate planning. In 2013, she won approval from a Georgia court to dissolve the trust, established by her father in 1941, that held her company shares, splitting it between family members and charities. A Cox spokesperson described this at the time as a maneuver related solely to the Cox family's goal of maintaining future ownership and control of Cox Enterprises. One upshot, Chambers said, was that he started to get more money faster and through a grantor retained annuity trust, a financial instrument used to minimize estate taxes. His assets accumulated to more than $5 million, and he ramped up his political funding and held organizing meetings at his gym. In the coming years, he brought supplies and trucks to the protests at the Standing Rock Reservation, where he said he saw everything that we recognize in America, what it was built on, and who we took it from, and how we did it, and how we do everything as a nation. In 2017, he bought 90 acres of land in Georgia. He and Park were joined by a man from the reservation, as well as another couple they met there. The Georgia group eventually came to include 14 people trying to grow food and hold retreats on 350 acres, but the project never took full flight. Too many anarchists, Chambers said, no party leadership. By then, he had come to see that income wouldn't be an issue. His media profile began to rise. He made the local news in August 2017 when one of his gyms banned police and active military members. Chambers told an NBC affiliate that he didn't want a heterojock space. When tabloids picked up the story, they usually described him as a lifelong activist. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selection by Mark Hoffman.